Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. We made it through the big event, and maybe we can steal a moment and find a cozy corner and a great book. As we approach the new year, those best of lists start popping up in every conceivable category. As more and more book lists surface, I'm proud to say that together in 2015, we've covered nearly all of the recommended reads. This week, I've referenced lists from Publishers Weekly and Goodreads and found intriguing titles we've not yet explored. My guest today, Elizabeth George, fills us in on her beloved Inspector Linley. Her latest, A Banquet of Consequences, is number 19 in the series. And Sarah Gruen, author of Water for Elephants, drops in to chat about her new title, At the Water's Edge. So get your reading list at the ready, and we'll turn to page one of the book report. Alexander von Humboldt, born in the mid-18th century, was an intrepid explorer and the most famous scientist of his age. His life was packed with adventure and discovery, whether climbing volcanoes or racing through anthrax-infested Siberia. He came up with a radical vision of nature, that it was a complex and interconnected global force that did not exist for man's use alone. Ironically, though his ideas have become accepted and widespread, he's been nearly forgotten. Now, Andrea Wolf brings the man and his achievements back into sharp focus in The Invention of Nature. Wolf traces his prediction of human-induced climate change, his discoveries of similarities between climate zones on different continents, and his relationships with iconic figures such as Simon Bolivar and Thomas Jefferson. David Drummond performs the bio of the man many call the forgotten father of environmentalism.
When Humboldt measured their altitude at 19,413 feet, he discovered that they were barely 1,000 feet below the peak. No one had ever come this high before, and no one had ever breathed such thin air. As he stood at the top of the world, looking down upon the mountain ranges folded beneath him, Humboldt began to see the world differently. He saw the earth as one great living organism, where everything was connected, conceiving a bold new vision of nature that still influences the way that we understand the natural world. Described by his contemporaries as the most famous man in the world after Napoleon, Humboldt was one of the most captivating and inspiring men of his time. Born in 1769 into a wealthy Prussian aristocratic family, he discarded a life of privilege to discover for himself how the world worked. As a young man, he set out on a 5-year exploration to Latin America, risking his life many times and returning with a new sense of the world. It was a journey that shaped his life and thinking, and that made him legendary across the globe. He lived in cities such as Paris and Berlin, but was equally at home on the most remote branches of the Orinoco River or in the Kazakh steppe at Russia's Mongolian border. During much of his long life, he was the nexus of the scientific world, writing some 50,000 letters and receiving at least double that number. Knowledge, Humboldt believed, had to be shared, exchanged, and made available to everybody. He was also a man of contradictions. He was a fierce critic of colonialism and supported the revolutions in Latin America, yet was chamberlain to 2 Prussian kings. He admired the United States for their concepts of liberty and equality, but never stopped criticizing their failure to abolish slavery. He called himself half an American, but at the same time compared America to a Cartesian vortex, carrying away and leveling everything to a dull monotony. He was confident, yet constantly yearned for approval. He was admired for his breadth of knowledge, but also feared for his sharp tongue. Humboldt's books were published in 12 languages and were so popular that people bribed booksellers to be the first to receive copies, yet he died a poor man. He could be vain, but would also give his last money to a struggling young scientist. He packed his life with travels and incessant work. He always wanted to experience something new, and, as he said, ideally, three things at the same time. Humboldt was celebrated for his knowledge and scientific thinking, yet he was no cerebral scholar. Not content in his study or among books, he threw himself into physical exertion, pushing his body to its limits. He ventured deep into the mysterious world of the rainforest in Venezuela and crawled along narrow rock ledges at a precarious height in the Andes to see the flames inside an active volcano. Even as a 60-year-old, he traveled more than 10,000 miles to the remotest corners of Russia, outpacing his younger companions. Fascinated by scientific instruments, measurements, and observations, he was driven by a sense of wonder as well. Of course, nature had to be measured and analyzed, but he also believed that a great part of our response to the natural world should be based on the senses and emotions. He wanted to excite a love of nature. At a time when other scientists were searching for universal laws, Humboldt wrote that nature had to be experienced through feelings. Humboldt was unlike anybody else because he was able to remember even the smallest details for years: the shape of a leaf, the color of soil, a temperature reading, the layering of a rock. This extraordinary memory allowed him to compare the observations he had made all over the world, several decades or thousands of miles apart.
That was The Invention of Nature by Andrea Wolf. Elizabeth George is the award-winning creator of the incredibly popular Inspector Linley of New Scotland Yard series. Yet, Elizabeth hails from Ohio and is a graduate of the University of California. Elizabeth began her professional career as a teacher, and during her 13 and a half years, she had the distinction of being named Orange County Teacher of the Year. Luckily for us, Elizabeth left teaching when she sold her first novel, A Great Deliverance. Today we'll speak with Elizabeth about A Banquet of Consequences, Book 19 in the Inspector Linley series. Welcome, Elizabeth. I'm thrilled to have you back with us on the Book Report.
Great. It's great to be here.
Many of your readers are surprised to learn you're American. When and how did your fascination with England begin?
My fascination with England began in the early 60s when I was just at the age when one becomes aware of pop culture. At that period of time in the 60s, everything that was oriented toward pop culture was British.
Do you spend part of your year now in England?
No, I don't really. I live in the Pacific Northwest, and I go to England when it's time to do research on a book or when I want to just see what might be going on in London that's different from what was going on when I was last there. So I like to sort of keep on top of what's going on in British society as best I can from a distance and then from actually experiencing it.
How has Inspector Linley evolved from book one to now book 19?
Well, when I first began the novel, this series of novels, I knew a lot about Linley because I wanted to create a character who had a rich enough background to sustain an exploration of him throughout a series. And so I knew that he I knew that he had a title. I knew that what went along with that title was an estate in Cornwall in southwest England. I knew that he was his father had died and his mother was still alive, and his brother suffered with various kinds of addictions, and his sister was a widow. So I knew those things, and that gave me a lot of room to explore various aspects of his character that made him, you know, much more one of my intimates than he had been when I first began.
Detective Sergeant Barbara Havers is such a brilliant counterpoint to Linley. For those readers who've not yet met her, give us some background.
Barbara Havers is Linley's partner, and she was first created to because I needed to give Linley a case. You see, when I began, I I initially intended Simon St. James, the forensic scientist, to be one of my to be the main character. But after writing two novels that didn't get published, I decided to see if this guy Linley, who was a friend of St. James, could solve the case, because after all, he was a detective. So in order to do that, he needed a partner, and I created Barbara Havers. Barbara Havers is really Linley's polar opposite. Whatever he is, she is not. So he is an aristocrat, well-educated at Oxford. She is a working-class girl who stopped going to school after her secondary education. He's tall, she's short, he's attractive, she's unattractive, and you just go right down the line. This gave a natural tension to every scene that they were in, and tension, you know, leads to conflict, and conflict is the core of drama. So she has grown into, as it turns out, a quite beloved character for the readers, and in A Banquet of Consequences, she proceeds to take on half of the case in a location that that Linley is not. So we get to see her working with Winston and Cotta on a case that takes them to Shaftesbury, which is in Dorset, England.
Mm. Was it great fun or a tough challenge to create Caroline Goldacre, a woman who was a hideous habitual liar?
Certainly was a challenge to create Caroline Goldacre, but I created her knowing that she had a particular kind of personality disorder that I wanted to learn about and to explore.
We're speaking with Elizabeth George on the Book Report. Early on in the book, a journal was discovered by Caroline's younger son, and it seemed to be the reason he threw himself off a cliff. That's not a spoiler, but yet the notebook was not referenced again for most of the rest of the book. How difficult as a writer is that kind of restraint when weaving the story together?
Well, in doing a crime novel, you want to have information play out in such a way that the reader gets the requisite information, but doesn't necessarily know how to interpret the information. So I wouldn't say that it was difficult in withholding the existence of the journal from the reader, because it needed to, you know, it needed to appear at the appropriate moment. And if you have a piece of information like that and it appears at the wrong moment, the entire house of cards collapses.
How did you learn about sodium azide?
Oh, I was looking for a poison to use in A Banquet of Consequences, and I have, you know, like any crime novelist, I have a lot of different books that I can refer to, and I was going through the book attempting to find a particular poison, any, you know, a kind of poison that did what I wanted it to do, and so I really couldn't, I couldn't find exactly what I was looking for, and one of my fellow writers put me in touch with Dr. Doug Lyle in Southern California. And so he really enjoys helping crime writers and making suggestions and things like that. So I contacted him and told him what I was attempting to do and what I needed. And we went back and forth for a while until we came up with the poison that was really going to work.
Your books were mentioned several times in The Girl in the Spider's Web, which is the continuation of the Stieg Larsson series. They were described as Mikael Blomqvist's recreational reading. What was that like for you? Did you know about it beforehand?
I had been interviewed by Stieg Larsson a number of years ago, obviously prior to his death and prior to his career as a writer. So he would have been really familiar with my books. I only read the first one, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, long before it was published, and I came across my name in the book, and it was pretty amusing to see it. And I've had many people since then say, ask me if I knew that he referenced my books, and I think it was probably because he was really familiar with my work.
When you start to write another Linley novel, do you have it all worked out before you put pen to paper, or do the characters surprise you sometimes?
I always know who the killer is in one of my books, and before I actually start to write the novel, I know the victim and the motive behind the crime. What I do then is to people the world of that crime with individuals who would likely be touched by it or involved in it. Then I create those characters. So I would have to say that the characters themselves don't surprise me because they are, you know, they're created, so I know what their core need is, I know what their psychopathology is, I know their history.
And are you already thinking about a new Lindley novel?
Yes, I've done the research for the next Lindley novel, which I intend to have take place in both London and in Shropshire, which is northwest, it's a county northwest of London. And I was there in late September and early October doing the research for that book.
Any final thoughts about A Banquet of Consequences?
I think Banquet of Consequences has some surprises in store for the reader as far as the crime goes and as far as the continuing lives of the characters go as well.
All right. Well, Elizabeth, it certainly was a page-turner. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And now, let's listen to a sampling of A Banquet of Consequences, performed by John Lee.
She entered the Pride of Spitalfields, and her annoyance with him was such that she found she didn't much care if he followed. But follow he did, and they sat at the only table left, directly next to the door to the ladies, which shot a shaft of near-blinding fluorescent light on their faces every time someone ducked in or out. Music was playing, an iPod or iPhone, with a hook-up to something of a satellite nature, because it was a country and western mix of oldies only. Johnny Cash, foremost, with dashes of Willie Nelson, Patsy Cline, Garth Brooks, Randy Travis, and the Judds. Lily said, "You didn't answer me, William." He was looking round the pub, but brought his gaze back to her. "Untrue. I told you that. You tried to misdirect me, is what you did. So let's go back. You spoke to your mum. You told her what's happened before you told me." "I said this isn't about my mum." "Let me guess at the conversation. She told you to come home to Dorset. She told you that you can start again there. She promised help. Hers, your stepdad's. When are you breaking away from them?" "I'm not intending to live with mum. At least not permanently. It's only till I can get established. It's for the best." "God, I can even hear her voice in you," Lily fumed. "I'm thinking of Sherborne," he said, "or Somerset. Probably Yeovil because it's less costly, but the business itself will do better in Sherborne. There's money there. Even Mum says..."
"I don't want to hear what Mum says."
"It's London, Lily. It's tempting to have any kind of business in London."
"I have a business. It's working out."
"Tattoos, yes. Well, this is London after all. But what I'm trying to do, having my kind of business, what I'm good at here, people don't connect the way I need to connect in London. You said that yourself. The perfect place to be anonymous. But if one wants anything more than anonymity, it's not going to happen. I've heard you say that. It's no go for me here. It's only because of you I've hacked it for this long." She looked towards the bar. She thought uselessly about how trendy Spitalfields was becoming, as the city of London inched towards it, one hideous glass tower block at a time. Even here, God, not that far from where Jack the Ripper haunted the narrow Whitechapel streets, there were young women wearing pencil skirts and young men in suits, flirting with one another as they sipped white wine. White wine, for God's sake. Here, in the East End. They were only a sign that nothing ever stayed the same, that progress was relentless and that making progress applied not only to society and economics and science and everything else, but to people as well. She hated that, the very idea of constant change to which one had to become accustomed. But she also knew when fighting it was hopeless. She said to him, "I suppose that's it, isn't it?" "What's it?" "You and I. What else?" He reached for her hand across the table. His palm was damp where it covered her bald fist. He said, "You can come to Dorset as well. You can set up a shop there. I've already spoken to..." "Yes,
Right. To your mum. And she's assured you that there's plenty of scope for tattoos in a place like Dorset.
Well, yes, if it comes to that. You're reading her wrong, Lil. She wants you there as much as I do.
We've just heard A Banquet of Consequences by Elizabeth George. The story of A New Name follows Elena Ferrante's critically acclaimed My Brilliant Friend, which we previewed last month on November 21st. The two protagonists, Lila and Elena, are now in their 20s. Marriage appears to have imprisoned Lila, while Elena continues her journey of self-discovery. These young women share a complex and evolving bond that brings them close at times and drives them apart at others. Each vacillates between disregard and profound love for one another. With this complicated and meticulously portrayed friendship at the center of their emotional lives, the two girls mature into women, paying the cruel price that this passage exacts. Hilary Huber performs the book.
We kissed without stopping, behind a tree, in the doorway of a building, along dark alleys. We took a bus, then another, and reached the station. We went toward the ponds on foot, still kissing each other on the nearly deserted street that skirted the railroad tracks. I was hot, even though my dress was light, and the cold of the evening pierced the heat of my skin with sudden shivers. Every so often, Antonio clung to me in the shadows, embracing me with such ardor that it hurt. His lips were burning, and the heat of his mouth kindled my thoughts and my imagination. Maybe Lila and Stefano, I said to myself, are already in the hotel. Maybe they're having dinner. Maybe they're getting ready for the night. To sleep next to a man, not to be cold. The black sky was stained with pale clouds of stars. The pond's odor of moss and putrid earth was yielding to the sweeter scents of spring. The grass was wet, the water abruptly hiccuped, as if an acorn had fallen in it, a rock, a frog. We took a path we knew well, which led to a stand of dead trees, with slender trunks and broken branches. A little farther on was the old canning factory, with its caved-in roof, all iron beams and fragments of metal. I felt an urgency of pleasure, something that drew me from inside, like a smooth strip of velvet. I wanted desire to find a violent satisfaction, capable of shattering that whole day. I felt it rubbing, caressing and pricking at the base of my stomach, stronger than it had ever been. Antonio spoke words of love in dialect. He spoke them in my mouth, on my neck, insisting. I was silent. I was always silent during those encounters. I only sighed.
Tell me you love me,
he begged. Yes.
Tell me.
Yes. I said nothing else. I embraced him. I clasped him to me with all my strength. I would have liked to be caressed and kissed over every inch of my body. I felt the need to be rubbed, bitten. I wanted my breath to fail. He pushed me a little away from him and slid a hand into my bra as he continued to kiss me. But it wasn't enough for me. That night, it was too little. All the contact that we had had up to that minute, that he had imposed on me with caution, and that I had accepted with equal caution, now seemed to me inadequate, uncomfortable, too quick. Yet I didn't know how to tell him that I wanted more. I didn't have the words.
That was The Story of A New Name by Elena Ferrante. In James Hanaham's Delicious Foods, Darlene, once an exemplary wife and mother, finds herself devastated by the unforeseen death of her husband. Unable to cope with grief, she turns to drugs and quickly becomes an addict. One day, she disappears. Her son, 11-year-old Eddie, begins a frantic search for her. He doesn't know Darlene has been lured away with false promises of a good job and an easy life. A shady company named Delicious Foods had shuttled her to a remote farm. She is held captive, performing hard field labor to pay off her supposed debt for food, lodging, and the constant stream of drugs the farm provides to her and others imprisoned there. As Darlene struggles to reunite with Eddie, we find a tale that wrestles with timeless questions of love and freedom, forgiveness and redemption, and the will to survive. The author narrates.
In the smoking section, a lone waitress sat facing away from the counter, her body slack as any customer's. An urgent story resounded on the TV behind her. Some rock star in Seattle had shot himself dead. She stared at the highway as if it were God. It took Eddie a while to get her attention, but once he did, she snapped to and hopped over, spine straight, pen behind her ear. "Do you mind, miss? Can't light it myself," he said, his request muffled by the cigarette he'd wrangled from its box and picked up with his mouth. He grinned and raised his elbows, meeting the woman's eyes with his own. "Oh, of course, right," she said, her wide eyes failing to mask her surprise. She struck a match and he inhaled the fire through the cigarette. "Gonna be a nice day," she announced, like something profound. "Let me know if you need anything else." Her name tag said Sandy, pinned onto a dingy pink dress with a gray apron wrapped around it. Under her nasal tone, something cared so strongly that Eddie moved sideways down the bench a little, crab-like, to avoid the power of her interest, fearing that she might get to know him against his will. Sandy turned away. "Actually, I'm looking for work," Eddie blurted out to her back. He wasn't looking yet, really, but suddenly he needed her kindness, superficial or not, craved it beyond his ability to stay distant. "Near here," he went on. He didn't think Bethella would let him sponge for long, if at all. She might not even care that he'd lost his hands. She'd probably blame his mother. Sandy turned and the glow left her face. "Hmm," she said. "What kind?" "Of work can I do? You'd be surprised. Fixing stuff, computers. I also do carpentry, wiring, odd jobs." Doubt spread across her face, and Eddie thought he could almost read her mind. "Now how can this boy do that in his condition?" He sat up. "I can do just about anything I set my mind to," he said, pouring brightness over her hesitation. "God makes three requests of his children. Do the best you can, where you at, with what you got now." "That's beautiful," Sandy said. "I bet your mama told you that." Eddie smiled because he knew his mother would never have said such a thing. He'd picked up the saying from Mrs. Vernon, but then it occurred to him that Sandy would think the smile meant, "Yes, Mama sure did." Confirming that her fantasy of his life was the truth would make her more likely to help. After a brief chat, he told her his full name and she wrote it down on a wet napkin. He figured he'd never hear from her again. It took Eddie a day and a half to find Bethella. He asked one of the few black pedestrians where he could find a beauty shop, adding that he meant to find his aunt. The pedestrian asked his aunt's name, which she didn't recognize, and then recommended he try Marquita's Beauty Palace on Saint Germain. To get there, Eddie had to drive across the Mississippi River. He read the sign aloud as he crossed. It astounded him to think that this was the same river as the one near his hometown, Ovis, Louisiana, and that it flowed as far as he had just driven. Seeing the same river here helped him adjust. The Great River wasn't wide or grand in Minnesota, but it didn't fill him with the same panic as it had back home. It had less to do with death. The past didn't slither through this shallower water. He didn't imagine any drowned ghosts staring up from the riverbed or bobbing out of culverts, their googly eyes asking, "Why?" St. Cloud pacified him. Its evenly spaced suburban homes reminded him of a balsa wood city he'd seen in a children's book. Even its housing complexes sat comfortably beyond tall, healthy trees and sprawling plots of grass, and though 100 Dayglo toys might lie upturned on one driveway, the next several lots would have neatly arranged yards, already flashing a few green shoots, while here and there a crocus forecast a pleasant spring. It felt more like home than Ovis, a place he hadn't seen in almost a decade. Eddie circled the area for nearly half an hour without getting out of the car, suddenly embarrassed not to have hands after what he took to be Sandy's condescension. But eventually, thinking of how his mother needed him back in Louisiana, he parked at a beauty shop and nudged the door open with his shoulder, holding his arms behind his back with calculated ease.
That was Delicious Foods by James Hanahan. Author Sarah Grun was born in Vancouver, grew up in Ontario, and earned a degree in English literature at the University in Ottawa. Sarah moved to the U.S. in 1999 to take a technical writing job. When she was laid off 2 years later, she decided to try writing fiction. Sarah's an animal lover, and both her first novel, Riding Lessons, and her second novel, Flying Changes, involve horses. Gruen's third book, her breakthrough novel, was set in a circus. Water for Elephants was adapted into a popular movie, starring Reese Witherspoon and Christoph Waltz in 2011. Sarah lives in western North Carolina with her husband and sons. Today we'll speak with her about her new novel, At the Water's Edge. Welcome, Sarah. It's great to have you with us on the Book Report. What inspired you to write the story of Ellis, Maddie, and Hank?
I was busy procrastinating one day, which is about 80% of my job. And I ran across an internet story that was about some declassified documents. And one of them was a letter from a high-level Scotland Yard official from 1938 that was discussing the monster and how he didn't think it could be protected from the police. But the thing that captivated me was that nowhere in the conversation was there any hint of a doubt that it existed. And so I just fell down a Nessie rabbit hole. And at the end of the afternoon, I had determined that that was where the setting sort of around that area subject. And so I booked my first research trip.
For the readers who have not yet read your book, can you give us a little overview?
Of the book?
Yes.
It's it starts out with this high society couple, actually sort of a threesome because their best friend is hanging around with them and always has. The main couple fall out with the father-in-law and get cut off financially, and of course they're too rich to do anything or know how to do anything, so they have to get back into his good graces, and so they decide that they will succeed where he failed, and that is to find the Loch Ness Monster. And so despite the Battle of the Atlantic raging, they bribe their way onto a freighter, and off they go.
So the father had tried to find the Loch Ness Monster previously.
Yes, the famous surgeon's photo of the Loch Ness Monster, I incorporated it into my book as the colonel's photo. And so there's a photo, and there was speculation after several weeks of celebrity and fame for him that perhaps he had faked it.
It must be great fun to set the book in the Blue Blood Society of Philadelphia in the 1940s. How did you research that?
I didn't. I made it up.
I believed it. Did you travel to the Scottish Highlands to get the setting so right?
I did. I spent 5 weeks there in total. I was there in February 1st, and then the next time I went was in the summer. But I loved it in February because I'm Canadian, so that's my kind of weather.
And did you find that the locals do believe in Nessie?
Yes, although they don't talk about it with outsiders at first. They have a healthy distrust of outsiders, but once you get to know them a little bit, and if you're in their home, and if you are introduced to them through friends, then eventually I think every one of them that I met came up with some sort of a anecdote, and the last one came in very recently. It was somebody that I visited with, and when I sent a signed copy of the book in the card, she told me about her encounter. So,
and do they describe it sort of as looking like a dinosaur, or how do they describe it?
They don't. It's just sort of a dark thing in the water. And so there are various things that has been described as, and an overturned boat is one of the things that is actually sort of on the list of them. Because there are various theories about this. The loch itself is physically different than most other bodies of water and is prone to optical illusion. And it's also extremely deep, and there's a big, enormous silt pile of peat, basically, at the bottom. So these trees, when they die and they fall in and go to the bottom, they get stuck in all this heat, and then they rot, and then they get full of gas, and then they explode to the surface. And so there are theories that, you know, the exploding logs are actually the Loch Ness Monster. But, you know, I've seen seals in the Loch, and I've seen otters in the Loch, and I've seen deers in the Loch, and from a distance, every one of those and could appear to be a monster. So sturgeon, you know, I think they've all been called a monster at some point.
We Americans tend to overlook the deprivations in war-torn Europe during World War II. How did you manage to convey it so compellingly?
I had to really, first of all, really research it and figure out and find the ration books and find out, you know, even if you have the rations for it, did that mean that the shops had it? And if they didn't, if you could actually go and get it somewhere else? And most of the time, no. It was just, you know, so I got some of the ration books, and my family gamely agreed to try to live on rations for a month. And after a couple of days, the kids decided they were having no more of that. And there was one night, it was really funny, because Bob and I were eating something called cheese and onion pudding. And the ingredients were fat and flour, basically. It said that if you had some stale bread, you could slice it thinly and put it at the bottom. And if you had some rinds of cheese, you could put it on the top. But there was no cheese in this cheese and onion pudding. So we lasted, I think, 2 weeks. But really, and it's also just going and imagining and really just getting into my head. But I did a lot of research on what you could and couldn't get, and the make do and mend and all of these things.
We're speaking with Sarah Gruen on The Book Report. The attraction between Maddie and Angus was very hot, and wouldn't we all love to have an Angus in our lives? How have readers responded to the romance?
I think they all agree that everyone needs an Angus in their life.
I have an Angus in my life.
Me too.
Well, are you already at work on a new project?
I am. I'm in the research phases.
Can you give us a glimpse?
Well, I can't really, because I don't ever know the plot until I start writing. And so, you know, my book proposal was one of these crazy things, which started out by saying, this is going to be a very, you know, unusual book proposal, because I never know my plot till I'm writing. I could give you a plot, but it won't resemble the final book at all. So why don't we just not waste time?
Are you a writer who carves out 5 hours a day, and whatever you're doing, you must be at your desk during those 5 hours, or what's your process?
It's more like 7 or 8, and it's usually just until I'm absolutely spinning my wheels and I can't get anywhere else, and I realize that what's taking me 2 hours right now, I could get done in 15 minutes if I actually went to bed.
How long did it take you to write this book?
Gosh, I don't actually know. I was very late, because I had a couple of, there were, my youngest son was very ill for a while during that, and so there was a good year for that. And so it's hard to say. I mean, I think maybe 3 years, but I don't know how much of that was entirely just writing.
What was it like for you to have your book, Water for Elephants, made into a movie? And were you involved, and did you coach the actors to talk about that?
Well, it was pretty surreal. And I didn't believe it until it started filming. And in fact, I'm not sure I really believed it until they showed me it for the first time in the screening room, and then it was real. But it was very cool. It was very fun. And because I think, you know, the minuscule percentage of books that get sold, the film rights get sold, actually get turned into movies, I threw everything in, like, the kitchen sink into the contract. And so I threw cameos for my whole family in, and this and that and the other thing. I said, oh, so they made the movie, and so my family's in it.
Okay, tell us, so we know where to look for them.
Well, I have 3 boys, and so my husband and the boys are all dressed like all the other men, but I am in a white dress with red polka dots and a cloche hat. And in the scene where Rosie is raiding the grocery stand, and when Rob Pattinson rushes by and elbows a woman out of the way and says, excuse me, ma'am, that's me.
How was it working with an elephant?
She's terrific. But you're very mindful of the size, and especially in the crowd scene when you're behind her, and if she steps up, it's, you know, you got to back up, and there's people behind you. And yeah, elephants, being very close to an elephant, especially after researching for this book, makes me nervous.
Yeah. So any final thoughts about At the Water's Edge?
I miss the characters, and I'm actually going back to Scotland in about a month, so I'm going to have to, you know, get to see all my favorite haunts again and have haggis one last time.
Not my favorite Scottish treat, but I love the countryside and I love the people. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
To listen to a sample of At the Water's Edge, check bookreportradio.com, archived shows, week of May 9th, 2015. Just in time for the entertainer's centennial, James Kaplan brings us Sinatra, the Chairman, the sequel to his best-selling Frank, the Voice. Kaplan goes behind the legend to give us the man in full. Peerless singer, actor, business mogul, lover, and associate of the powerful and infamous. The book picks up in 1954, the day after Frank claimed his Academy Award. His life post-Oscar was incredibly dense. In between recording albums and singles, he often shot 4 or 5 movies a year, did TV shows and nightclub appearances, started Reprise, his own label, and juggled his considerable commercial ventures. With his music so timeless, this in-depth look at a fascinating man will keep you turning pages. Donald Koren performs the book.
Doris Day's words, dripping with ambivalence about her co-star in Warner Brothers' 1954 musical melodrama Young at Heart, remind us that human beings are complicated creatures, and that no human was more complicated than Frank Sinatra. In the comeback year of 1954, as Frank regathered the vast power he'd lost, he also achieved new heights of arrogance. There was Sinatra, and then there was everybody else. He knew it, and the world knew it. Doris Day had first gotten to know Sinatra when they worked together in 1947 on Your Hit Parade. In her autobiography, she recalled that when Frank's fortunes had dipped and he was working the nightclubs, her husband, Martin Melcher, urged her to show her support by going to the Coconut Grove to hear him singing. The Coconut Grove was a cavernous place, Day recalled, and when it was only a third filled, as it was that evening, it had a melancholy air. Frank's voice had changed. He wasn't singing the way he had sung before or the way he sings now. He seemed uncertain. Frank came over to our table and sat with Marty and me for a while and had a drink. He knew he wasn't singing the way he wanted to. Of course, we didn't talk about that, but he seemed a little embarrassed. About the small turnout, too. Sinatra had bounced back, but American popular music was still hip-deep in schlock in 1954, with hits like Shaboom by the Crew Cuts, Archie Blyer's Hernando's Hideaway, the Four Aces' Three Coins in the Fountain, and Eddie Fisher's Oh My Papa blaring from the nation's radios and jukeboxes. And Mitch Miller was still going strong at Columbia, still forcing great singers into recording mediocre material that, in the coercively conservative climate of the times, turned into popular hits. The bouncy, negligible R&B number Make Love to Me, foisted by Miller on the sublime balladeer Joe Stafford, hit number one that year, as did This Old House, the hoedown-style monstrosity that he inflicted on Rosemary Clooney. No one was telling Frank what to record at Capitol. Among the 37 singles, soundtrack tunes, and album numbers he laid down in 1954, there were some interesting missteps, but they were his missteps. And Sinatra and Riddle were mostly making genius together, especially on the albums. Continuing the prescient model he had initiated at Columbia with 1946's Voice of Frank Sinatra, Frank organized each of his Capitol compilations around a specific mood or mode, downbeat or upbeat, ballads or swingers. The term concept album wouldn't be coined until much later, but Sinatra invented the idea and Riddle helped him perfect it. More than ever, he was far more than just a singer. He was an artist shaping his medium. At the same time, there was always the dark undertow, the inner voices that told him that underneath it all he was nothing and nobody, a little street guinea from Hoboken. The furies that would frequently blind him when his vulnerabilities were touched, the terrible impatience, with the incompetence and stupidity that were so rife in the world, with things he needed to happen instantaneously and so rarely did. The realization that he was like nobody else and therefore destined to be alone. His terrors of aloneness itself, of sleep, the cousin to death, and always, always the vast and ravening appetites. When all these things are taken together, is it any wonder that he often showed up on the Burbank soundstage for Young at Heart 2 or 3 or 4 hours later than anyone else?
That was Sinatra, the Chairman, by James Kaplan. Readers, I ask you, how can you resist a book entitled, Is Fat Bob Dead Yet? Stephen Dobbin's tale begins in the seaport city of New London, Connecticut. Newcomer Connor Raposo has just witnessed a gruesome motorcycle accident. At least he thinks it was an accident. But then he sees a familiar man who sports an Elvis pompadour. He's lurking around the scene of the crime. Where does Connor know him from? And why does everyone he knows keep showing up dead? If you're a fan of the dark comedies of Elmore Leonard and Carl Hiaasen, this is a title you'll enjoy. George Newbern performs the book.
The man climbs from his mini and glances at the caprice with mild interest, but before he can cross the street, he's startled by a blast from a train's air horn. About 40 passenger trains come through New London each day, and two-thirds stop. Amtrak's Northeast Regional and the Acela Express, as well as a commuter line between New London and New Haven. And each blasts its horn. As if in response, the mini goes beep, beep, as the locks click shut, and the man continues across the street to a shoe repair shop. The Greek shop owner has been there for more than 30 years and prefers to be called a cobbler. The man is on his way to pick up a pair of shoes, new soles, heels, and a good polishing for his black Bruno Mali slip-ons, a rush job because he only took them in on Saturday. The shoes were a gift from his older brother Vasco. Actually, they're hand-me-downs that Vasco found too tight. Vasco has rich tastes, and over the years his brother has benefited. Another item taken from Vasco is a purposeful stride, leaning forward and walking quickly, which, when a teenager, our friend liked enough to copy, and which makes any destination seem the only one possible. The man's name is Connor Raposo, though his Portuguese parents baptized him Juan Carlos, and into his late teens, everyone called him Zeco. But just before college, he decided he needed a new identity and changed his name to Connor. He's in his mid-20s, thin, 6 feet tall, straight nose, chestnut eyes, moderately handsome, black hair that grazes the collar of his jacket, though if we were really looking down from a cherry picker, we might see an incipient bald spot, which in 20 years, if he lives that long, will overspread his dome. Besides his purposeful walk, he has a purposeful face. Connor will appear somber even when telling a joke, but his expression derives from the shyness he felt as a kid. It discouraged people from talking to him. You know that bromide, he's laughing on the outside but crying on the inside? Connor's just the opposite. Unlike the pasty winter faces of others on Bank Street, Connor's face is tanned, which is no surprise since he left San Diego a week ago, and yesterday, dropping off his shoes, was his first visit to New London. What else? He wears jeans, running shoes, and a brown leather jacket he's had since college. But to move along, Connor has given the elderly cobbler his claim ticket, and the cobbler has held up the black Bruno Mali's for Connor's inspection. He sets them on the counter, where they glisten like anthracite. The leather soles are a change for Connor. Usually he wears soft, rubber-soled shoes, and he walks as softly as a wink. Whether to sneak towards something or sneak away, he can't be sure. The cobbler counts out a fistful of $1 bills, Connor's change, while apologizing for having nothing bigger. You want the bag? The cobbler has great tufts of hair sprouting from his ears, woolly entanglements to snatch the oncoming words one by one. Never mind, my car is right across the street. He stuffs the bills into his jacket pocket. A sound grows audible, a distant purr which leads the cobbler to shake his head.
The first of the season, just like Robin's.
Then, seeing Connor's blank expression, he adds,
Harleys, spring, summer, and fall, they come roaring past.
The distant purr changes to a low rumble that increases in volume and reverberates off the stone buildings. It's an intrusion that loosens the mind from previous thoughts. Indignant seagulls flap away toward the water.
We have noise restrictions in California.
Connor had a noisy Harley in college and loved it.
Can't you make a complaint?
Before the cobbler can answer, the Harley flashes by, twin headlights, a blur of candy orange, stinger wheels, Tommy gun pipes, lots of chrome, a growl like a brontosaurus. It's a snapshot shooting past the window. The plate glass shivers. Then everything gets faster yet. The roar of a second motor rises above the roar of the Harley. A woman screams, a squeal of rubber to make Connor brace himself. Next comes a packed combination of noises, a collision of metal against metal, a wrenching shriek, glass breaking, the crunch and clatter of hundreds of little bits scattered across the pavement. A window shatters, and hidden within the variations of smash is the sound of a speeding biker striking an immovable object.
We've just heard a sampling of Is Fat Bob Dead Yet? By Stephen Dobbins. Readers, I hope you've enjoyed this spotlight on some of 2015's most buzzed about books. For more top titles, check bookreportradio.com. Wishing you and yours a 2016 filled with stunning adventures, many magic moments, and a library full of great reads. Happy New Year! See you next week for the first 2016 edition of The Book Report.